Welcome to Vegas Inc. Radio. I'm Dellen Goldberg, host of the show and business editor of Vegas Inc. and the Las Vegas Sun. Over the next half hour, we'll be discussing a lot of news about a variety of topics, including long hauling, the illegal practice of taking tourists mostly the long way from the airport to the strip, a new mini boom in healthcare in Las Vegas and the Valley, and a new book from our former Las Vegas mayor, Oscar Goodman. But first, we're going to turn our attention to the topic du jour, guns. Guns is a big, they're a big industry here in Las Vegas and a booming business, but they're also a source for international mockery. A lot of international outlets, media outlets, and critics have looked at Las Vegas as almost a joke with our shotgun weddings, literally, and our proliferation of shooting ranges. I'm here with reporters Eli Siegel and Rick Velada, who looked at why guns are such big business here and what it means for our image and our tourism industry. Welcome.
Hi, Dylan.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So, Eli, you went around to a lot of the gun shops and you reported that essentially they can't keep their merchandise on the shelves.
That's right, especially for the military-style rifles like the AK-47 and the AR-15 in particular. Those are basically sold out right now at the retailers that I talked with. They told me that we can't keep them on the shelves, things like that. They are literally sold out of them. And a lot of that is because in the aftermath of the Newtown, Connecticut shootings, where 26 people were killed at an elementary school in mid-December, there's been a lot of talk, and I think there were even recommendations today by President Obama about cracking down on gun ownership and implementing new regulations. And so a lot of people came to the stores before these recommendations were made today. A lot of people had been coming to the stores in the last few weeks to basically load up on gear and training because they were worried that they might not be able to get these guns if they are outlawed. And so you saw a lot of people buying these rifles, and you also saw a major uptick in people signing up for classes to get a concealed weapons permit as well.
It's much like the run we saw on Hostess products when they went out of business, but obviously this is a much more serious, potentially, product. Are these people going out and shooting them? Are they hobby shooters, or are they just stockpiling for the end of the world or because they're not going to be able to get them?
You know, I'm not really sure what they're doing with the weapons. I would suspect a lot of them take the guns to ranges themselves where they can fire them. In a lot of cases, I would suspect they just keep them at home and they don't use them. I think a lot of gun owners are that way in general. So it's tough to say what they're doing with these rifles.
And they're selling so fast. You said that the owner of the gun store, Bill Irwin, actually paid retail for some of these weapons and then still turned around and made a pretty significant profit.
That's right. He told me that because he was almost out at his store. Now, granted, his business is mostly driven by his gun range, where they have these shotgun weddings and things like that. The retail store is actually pretty small, but he did at one point he told me that they almost ran out of these rifles. And he couldn't get any from any distributors, from any wholesale suppliers. So he went to some retail stores and bought five or six of them, marked them up by $500, and then within 2 days he had sold them all for about $2,000 a piece.
It's incredible. And you said he's limiting the amount of ammunition people can buy, not for safety, just for product control.
That's right, because people are coming in and they want to buy a lot, and he can't do that because it's basically not fair to the other customers. He's going to turn away. He might lose a lot of customers if he didn't. So, which is a pretty common technique, I think, that retailers do when there's any kind of shortage or perceived shortage of products.
And you said you reported in your Vegas Inc. story that one guy came back every day for a week, something like that, to stock up.
That's right. Not at his store, but at the Range 702, which is opened just a few months ago over on Dean Martin Drive, just west of the Strip. And one of the people who worked at the store, she told me that she had a guy come in literally every day in the past week or in a recent week and bought a gun every day because he's worried about what kind of new regulations there might be and if he won't be able to get these guns.
Wow.
So it's a boom for business.
Yeah.
Among other things.
Absolutely. And there's been a proliferation in the last year, or even the last 6 months, of these shooting ranges. There's several on, well, there's one on the Strip and several right off the Strip. And those are aimed mostly at tourists who come to shoot because they can't shoot in their own country. How big a business is that, Rick?
Well, you know, just the fact that we have so many of them here, and that they've become more popular over, particularly over the last year, I think, that we're seeing more and more of these. You're actually seeing a lot of business that, and it's just a novelty of coming to Las Vegas. It's something that you can't do in your hometown. So one of the things I'm going to do when I go to Las Vegas is I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I can shoot an AK-47. I mean, I've never done that before, and I don't have the desire to, but I think a lot of people out there who have this, they see the opportunity, they're going to look at it and say, yeah, that's something that I just want to try just so that I can say that I did it. And it just turns out that it happened in Las Vegas. So even though I think this is really just a fraction of the tourists who come to Las Vegas in terms of having some other activity to do, and there's obviously dozens of things to do when you're here, it's still pretty big business, and the fact that they can draw enough people to make this a lucrative venture, I think that kind of speaks to the fact that this is, in fact, a tourism enterprise for Las Vegas.
Absolutely, and as you reported, in some ways, this fits perfectly with Las Vegas's image of, you know, both the Wild West and our cowboy libertarian bent, as well as just the naughtiness of the city and being able to do things you don't do normally at home. But is this a good thing to promote, or does this hurt us as, you know, crazy American gun happy culture?
I think it's all in the point of view on that. When Las Vegas began marketing itself, the base theme is adult freedom. You're able to do what you want to do, when you want to do it. We're 24/7 in this town, and there's all kinds of different things that you can do that can express your view of freedom. Well, for some people, that view of freedom is to be able to go out and fire a weapon. Again, there are so many different things that one can do, but just the fact that you are free to be able to do that speaks, it's just right in the wheelhouse of the Las Vegas theme of being able to do stuff that you don't ordinarily do. So, you know, is it bad for our image? The Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority hasn't really done any studies that would indicate one way or the other whether this is detrimental or not. Now, we've all seen some of the press clippings that have appeared in foreign countries. They mock Las Vegas. They make fun of the fact that we're a bunch of gun-toting cowboys. But at the same time, that's one of the appeals of this town, is to be able to do stuff that you just can't do.
Well, and what you're referencing is British, a lot of the British tabloids and media from other countries have shown pictures from the gun store and a couple of our other shooting ranges of brides and grooms with their long guns posing lovingly with each other.
And
their
actually
guns.
Saw that on a Facebook page once, and it really just disturbed me a little bit.
It's not something you see every day, that's for sure. And they have these literal shotgun weddings where you pay however many hundreds of dollars. They've got ordained ministers on staff, and you get hitched, you go shoot, and make
brings
a night
a whole
out of
new
it.
Meaning to shotgun wedding, and I think that's by design that they play off that. But at the same time, I don't think you're going to see anybody from the tourism industry saying that this is a bad thing necessarily. Even though we might get laughed at, we get laughed at for a lot of things in this town. But the fact is that we are one of the few places where you can do some of that stuff.
Well, they say no press, any press is good
press,
right. And we found that out with Prince Harry, and we make fun of ourselves, so maybe this isn't such a bad thing for our image.
What happens here stays here.
Exactly, including shooting ranges. For those just joining us, you're listening to Vegas Inc. Radio, part of Waking Up with the Sun. We're here every Monday at 7 a.m. on KUNV 91.5 The Source. I'm your host, Dellen Goldberg, business editor of Vegas Inc. and the Las Vegas Sun, and I'm speaking today with reporters Rick Velotta and Eli Siegel. Let's switch gears now and talk about long hauling. Unlike shooting, this is very much illegal here in Las Vegas. Rick, why don't you tell us a little bit about what exactly long hauling is and what at least one company is doing to crack down on it?
Well, long hauling is the illegal practice of taking a taxi cab customer on a longer route in order to get a higher fare. It's expressly illegal in the Nevada revised statutes, but there are some little places where you can kind of get around that. For example, if I'm a cab driver and I want to tell my customer that it might take you a lot longer if we take the surface streets to get to the destination, would you like to go a faster route? And that passenger gives consent to do that, then it no longer becomes a long hauling issue. So there are places where drivers have had the opportunity to kind of work the system a little bit in order to do this. But by the same time, everything's legal when you go about it in that way. Now, one of the companies that is involved in a project is run by Mark James, and it's one of the things that they have been doing is working on some technology, and the technology is a hardware and software system that will track the direction, speed, and route of any vehicle, and then capture that in a database, and then play it back. So this becomes a great tool for doing some enforcement on the potential problem of long hauling. What you do is that if there's a question about somebody possibly taking somebody on a longer route, you just call back that find it by a time index, locate that trip, and then play it, and you can actually see exactly where the cab went, how fast it went, what time it picked up the passenger, and what time it dropped off the passenger. What that does then is that it launches the opportunity to have an investigation in which the passenger can be questioned in terms of whether or not they were asked whether they would prefer to take the longer but potentially faster route. And that's something that that the regulatory industry's looking at, and certainly Mr. James is looking at trying to find an opportunity to sell this to regulators, not just in Nevada, but in taxicab regulatory regimes all across the country. Because this isn't just a problem that occurs here. It occurs elsewhere. But just the fact that the Frias cab company, which is that's his company, is located here, they're offering themselves up as an opportunity to test this. And they've already gone to the Nevada Transportation Authority. And that's a different agency than the Taxi Cab Authority. It's the agency that actually oversees limousines, buses, and they also do taxi cabs, but outside of Clark County. Well, next, he's going to take this to the Taxi Cab Authority, which does have jurisdiction over 16 cab companies that work in Clark County, and see if they want to do some kind of a test program as well. So we may very well see the software and hardware enacted here in a test capacity.
Do you think the Taxi Cab Authority will be on board with this?
Well, I think that they'll love the technology, and they'll love the fact that there's an ability to potentially relieve a problem that has plagued Southern Nevada for many years. But the thing that's going to be problematic is the cost. The Frias company that put this together said they've invested millions of dollars to get the system to where it is now, through all the testing that they had to do, through some of the acquisition of technology in order to make this thing work, to put the GPS tracking system together to integrate it. So there's a lot of investment in this, and if it costs millions of dollars to put together, I'm not sure that anyone would be able to afford that. Now, of course, Mr. James has a solution to that, and that is to tack on a small fee to every taxi ride to pay for that. So you pay for the licensing of the software, and then you pick up a fee, but maybe it's 50 cents every time you get into a cab. And that adds up when you've got millions and millions of rides that occur on an annual basis in southern Nevada. So it could pay for it, and certainly it's something that Mr. James and the Frias Company is looking at marketing elsewhere, because if they can do this on a grander scale and maybe implemented in other jurisdictions, then that would be something that would recoup their investment quite quickly.
Do you think this is something that the cab companies would voluntarily adopt, or would be required by the regulatory agencies?
It's probably more likely to be something that the regulatory agency would require. And what that means is that they would be that the only requirement they would really have is to be able to put in the GPS tracking software. And then they also have a special screen that would basically replace the taximeter that's in most cabs right now. Everybody who's ever ridden in a cab has seen the meters and watched how their fare goes up every time they drive a few miles. This different screen, or this new screen, would just do it in a different way. And it would do it basically, it would be the same visual effect. You'd be able to watch your fare change from mile to mile and from minute to minute if it's tacking on some extra charges for wait time, that type of thing. So my thought is that if it is going to be adopted, it would be adopted by the regulators, and it would be required equipment to be placed in all cabs.
Now, with my apologies to Mr. James, I have to ask, isn't it a bit disingenuous? I mean, the Frias, the taxi cab, surely has at least a small portion, if not more rampant, of their drivers participating likely in long hauling. And instead of addressing the problem internally, they are creating a technology which then they're trying to sell to the government to make money. Why not just address the problem, say, hey, drivers, if you are caught long hauling, we're going to fire you and set a precedent that way?
Well, that's the longstanding debate. And it's not just with the Frias company, but all the taxi cab companies that operate here. And I think a lot of the public says, why can't they do this? Why don't they just fire these long haulers and put an end to this problem internally? It's a little bit harder to do, and part of the reason for that is that there are some companies that require their drivers to meet a quota, and the drivers feel like they're under pressure to meet that quota in order to keep their jobs. And therefore, what they end up doing is, say, they cheat the system, and there's a little less control. I mean, these drivers are pretty independent types. And you can tell them every day of the week, that you are not going to be long hauling, but they still end up doing it, and they find ways around the system. And as I pointed out earlier, they can use the system by saying to the passenger, "Hey, I can get you to your destination faster if you just let me go this different route," and that lets them off the hook.
Absolutely. Well, all our listeners can follow this coverage at VegasInc.com or LasVegasSun.com, or in the print versions of Vegas Inc. or the Las Vegas Sun. This is Vegas Inc. Radio, part of Waking Up with the Sun. We're here every Monday at 7 a.m. on KUNV 91.5, The Source. Eli, let's switch gears and talk about a little mini boomlet of healthcare facilities that are popping up in the Valley. We've got plans for a pretty extensive medical center for people with mental disabilities, as well as a hospice center popping up.
That's right. And there are other projects as well. I think Mountain View Hospital, they're expanding. There's at least one other hospice facility I know of that's popping up. And then in Henderson, you've got Union Village, which is an enormous multi-billion dollar, or at least $1 billion or $2 billion complex that I think is scheduled to start construction next year. And just the latest is there's a new hospice center being built right now as we speak over on Jones Boulevard, just a little north of the 215 Beltway. And it's a new facility. It's a 19,000 square foot, two building campus, being opened by Infinity Hospice Care. And Infinity, they have patients in Vegas, Reno, Pahrump, and Phoenix, but they don't have any facilities that they operate. What they do now is they serve people in their homes, or they have contracts to go into non-hospice nursing facilities and provide hospice care there. And hospice is basically the same everywhere, which is they serve terminally ill people who have a life expectancy of no more than 6 months. And they're basically providing they're basically treating the symptoms and helping with pain management and things like that. And there's they don't attempt to cure these people, if you will, because they are terminally ill. So Infinity, they're opening. It's a 12-bed facility, and it's I think it's a $5 million complex. So it's pretty nice project that's going on over there.
And this is one of two hospice projects taking place right now.
That's right. And the Infinity's facility actually is exactly 1 mile south on Jones Boulevard from another 12-bed hospice center that's been there for 3 or 4 years now, operated by Solari Hospice Care. And Solari, they are planning to build another 12-bed facility up in northwest Las Vegas, and they've been scouting properties for possibly a third facility as well around the valley. So they're expanding too.
Is this an industry where we're lacking beds, for lack of a better word, or is this a growth potential that these companies see? Why sort of are they building now?
It's tough to say. I think they might be building because, maybe they're getting low interest construction loans and they can afford to build, and contractors are offering their services cheap, and so the building, maybe they've wanted to build a facility for a while, and now they can actually afford it because construction costs are probably a lot lower than they have been in recent years. On the other hand, whether there's a lot more people who need this sort of treatment, I'm not really sure, but they obviously see a demand. Otherwise, they wouldn't be investing this kind of money and time into building a new facility.
Right, absolutely. And also investing a lot of time and money is New Vista Ranch, which is a center. It's an existing center for people with mental disabilities, but now they're going to be an even bigger center and residential complex.
That's right. Yeah, New Vista, it's a really interesting place. It's up in northern Las Vegas, over by the Gilcrease Ranch, Gilcrease Farm, if you will. And right now what they have there, is, I think it was built about 10 or 12 years ago, and they have four homes on site with six residents each. And what they're planning to do, and then they also have homes that they own or rent kind of scattered around the valley where they also serve, they have staff and they serve patients there, or clients there rather. And what they're planning to do right now is to build nine more homes at their headquarters site, and to build a medical clinic in partnership with Torrey University, Nevada. And they haven't started construction yet, but they're planning to open the medical center this summer and one of the nine new homes this year as well. And that's the first phase. And the whole project will take a while. The CEO told me she's expecting it to take about 10 to 15 years. So, but these first two buildings should be up and running in the next year.
And what's the cost for this?
All in is $30 million. That's the whole thing.
That's pretty significant. And what you reported in your story was that essentially there might be a gap in services for this population. There's a lot of services for younger people with disabilities, but not so much the older people with mental disabilities.
That seems to be the case, yeah. And this medical clinic there, it's open to people of all ages, but it will serve a lot of adults, in particular the people who live at New Vista, many of whom are adults. And Andy Eisen, he's the Associate Dean for Clinical Education at Toro, and he told me that healthcare providers have made a lot of strides in treating children with Down syndrome and autism and other medical conditions, but there has not been as big of a focus on adults. And there are only a handful of adult-focused clinics out there around the country, and currently none in southern Nevada. So it's definitely an area that needs to be addressed.
And beyond providing medical care, they're hoping to find out more about treatment of these kind of ailments through research?
That's right. They're going to be collecting and analyzing data on the patients that they treat there and basically trying to figure out how best to treat these folks, because an adult with Down syndrome or autism has a lot more medical problems than the average person. These officials explained to me that there are higher rates of bronchitis, pneumonia, they have a lot of respiratory problems, things like that. But Kelly DeGuzman, she's the CEO of New Vista, she told me that no one really knows why. And so she's hoping to use this medical clinic as a way to do research and to figure out why are these folks suffering more than the average person and what's the best way to help them.
Great. Well, it sounds like very worthy work, and we'll be following it for, I guess, a decade to see how fast these houses pop
That's
up.
Right.
Well, Rick, let's turn to you to close out the show with some news from our beloved former Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman. He's going to be an author soon.
That's right. He's written a book. They've actually titled it Being Oscar, which I think is appropriate in this case. And it basically talks about his experiences from growing up in Philadelphia, through getting through law school at the University of Pennsylvania, and then his trek across the country to Las Vegas with his wife, and then how he became a mob lawyer, which, you know, it's not something that you get to learn about in law school. So I was pretty fascinated by just hearing some of his stories about how he got into the business that he got into. Obviously, using that that fame as a mob attorney and being a pretty respectable attorney around town, this is what catapulted him into the mayor's race back when he ran, and he was a three-term mayor. So his popularity is just unsurpassed as far as you know, what people in Las Vegas think about him.
And now his wife's the current mayor.
And now his wife's the current mayor. The thing about that is that I think if he would have been allowed to legally, he would have stayed as mayor just as long as he wanted to do it.
Absolutely.
But because he was term limited out, he had to come out. But now he has a new gig, and that is that he is the head of the host committee of the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. And basically what that is somebody who goes out and meets some of these big conventions that come to town and thanks them for coming. Being a good host is appreciating the fact that you like to come back here, and he has many examples of how he has spoken to some of these groups, and they've after he's thanked them for coming, they say, well, you know, we really appreciate the fact that you care about us, and we're going to come back. And that's what this is all about, is to get repeat business in our convention industry. So it's something that fits him very well. He's got the personality for it, and certainly now that he's going to have a book out on the market, it's going to be something that will keep his popularity on a nationwide scale, especially if this book does well.
Absolutely. We have only got a minute or two, but the book is being published by the Weinstein Brothers of movie fame.
Right.
And you said that there was some discussion that if it were to ever become a movie, who might play Oscar Goodman? What was the consensus?
Well, I don't know that there was a consensus. There were a lot of ideas thrown out that Oscar rejected, like, you know, George Clooney. I don't think he was...
Not handsome enough?
Well, I think he was handsome enough, but I don't think that he was the type of persona that would exude the Oscar Goodman flavor. But it will be interesting to see if that ever becomes a movie. And I think that one of the things that we all know is that he's been in the movies before, so wouldn't it be a shocker if he came back and played himself? I don't know that he would be able to pull that off from the young Oscar, but at the same time, Hollywood's full of miracles, so you never know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Stranger things have happened. Well, thanks so much, Rick Velotta and Eli Siegel, for joining us today on Vegas Inc. Radio. We're here every Monday at 7 a.m. on KUNV 91.5 The Source, part of Waking Up with the Sun. I'm your host, Dylan Goldberg, business editor of Vegas Inc. and the Las Vegas Sun. Thanks to Steven Zeller, our producer, and the entire KUNV team. And thanks to you for listening. Enjoy your day.